Welcome to Series 2 of my podcast Stories of Unconscious Bias. I'm Smitha Tharoor. In Series 1, I had the great privilege of hearing stories of unconscious bias from some wonderful people about a wide range of topics. I laughed, cried, and was moved in equal measure. I started this series because I wanted the listeners to realize that we are not alone. All of us have similar stories. They may not be the exact same, but when we hear them, we can hear the parallels in our lives. My speakers have all shared their learning and how they manage their unconscious biases, which is also a wonderful life lesson for us. Series 2 will follow the same style of interview. I hope you enjoy listening. Welcome, listeners. I would like to introduce someone who is very close to my heart. Many of you would already know of my brother Shashi Tharoor, author of 20 books, former Under Secretary General of the United Nations, former Minister in the Congress Government, MP of Trivandrum, speaks four languages fluently, etc. But would you also know that when I was four, he was also intrepid captain of a ship, commander of the bathtub, taking me to far-off places at bath time, die-hard vegetarian who worked hard at stopping his sister from eating meat or fish. And no, he wasn't successful. Advisor and supporter when I first got into debating and elocution, and general all-round older brother. Shashi, thank you so much for joining me on Stories of Unconscious Bias. Welcome.
Good to be with you, Smitha. I must say that if I really worked hard at stopping you from eating meat and fish, you wouldn't be eating it today. I was just being kind.
Okay, that's very kind of you. So tell me, unconscious bias, that's what we're talking about. Two simple words, perhaps. But what do you understand by those two words?
Well, I mean, I've always assumed when you told me you were working in the field of unconscious bias, that it was the kind of prejudice that people have instinctively, automatically, without really thinking about it. You know, some stereotype about a thing or a person or an emotion or a situation which influences the way they perceive it and the way they judge it, and which may be unfair because they simply are doing it on the basis of a preconceived prejudice.
Yes, absolutely. And the point about unfairness is spot on, because prejudice, it sounds perhaps negative, but it could be a positive unconscious bias or a negative opinion that you have. But the outcome, whether it's positive or negative, could be unfair. You're absolutely right. So when you're thinking unconscious bias, what kind of stories come to your mind? Your own personal stories, perhaps, where you might have shown unconscious bias?
I'd like to think that I'm above all of that, but of course, no one really is. All these years, I guess, I've had unconscious bias in seeing my younger sisters as little girls, even while they grew up to be adults and mothers and professionals, but they're still my younger sisters, and I think of them that way. There's an unconscious bias for you.
The thing
that I have to say is, you know, as your listeners may know, I spent 29 years at the United Nations, and a lot of my time there, we were constantly and quite consciously, I think, seeking to avoid bias on any of the possible grounds that might exist in other work environments, because we were an organization of and for the entire world. And so it was important for us that in our work, we didn't judge people by their nationality, their ethnicity, their color, their mother tongue, their accent, and so on. And it became very interesting to see that despite that, some people couldn't help let their biases show. And I mean this not just negatively, because sometimes one could say there was nothing particularly harmful, for example, in who people chose to have lunch with every day, whatever. I remember we had a At one time, we had a Pakistani brigadier and an Indian major who happened to be a Punjabi as well. And literally, for their service in the United Nations, they were together for about 2 or 3 months. Every single day, they went off to have lunch together and speak Punjabi to each other. There was clearly an affinity there that biased them in favor of each other. even though, of course, the two countries were at loggerheads and were theoretically hostile. And one day, the very same people may have been firing at each other. Who knows? But because they had a language, an ethnicity, a common cultural frame of reference, they had an unconscious bias that selected each other as their lunch companion.
That's a great
So that's
story.
What I mean by sort of, that's a benign bias.
No, that's here, go ahead.
Sorry, no, if it wasn't benign, correct me. You're the expert.
Not at all. No, I was going to just respond to that and say the four point, two bits of that I wanted to react to. One was the fact that you called it an affinity. And that's exactly what it is. And what many people don't know is that there are about 150 types of unconscious biases. And one of them is called affinity bias. And these two Punjabi-speaking gentlemen, doesn't matter which country they came from or their loyalties were with, but because they could sit together and have lunch and speak the same language, they felt a sense of comfort and a sense of belonging with each other. And that's a very good example of affinity bias. But there was something else that you said slightly earlier, which I wanted to just pick up because it is something that you and I both have. And I thought in the context of siblings talking to each other and challenging unconscious biases, and that's about accent. Now, a lot of people say to me, and I suspect say to you or think certainly when they hear you speak, that you and I both have what are considered posh accents. Now, what does that then mean? I mean, if somebody has said that to you, or what do you understand about your own accent? And perhaps what kind of unconscious biases people may have when they hear you or me?
Well, again, depends on where people are saying this. So when I was in Geneva for the UN and an English woman said I had a posh accent, it clearly wasn't said with a great deal of fondness because she came from a different sort of background, had a more distinctive accent, even though she was herself English. Thought I sounded like a toff without being entitled to be one. I think that was the implicit rebuke. When I hear it in India, what they're, I think, saying is, you don't sound like the rest of us, therefore you are somehow estranged from us. You are, how shall we put it, you are different, your accent speaks of privilege, of foreign living and foreign exposure, and therefore you're not authentically one of us when people say it there. So, I mean, I think there's always, you're right, that accent can be used to separate people from the person noticing the accent. I mean, it doesn't have to be like that. It can also be benign. I mean, let's say that sometimes a kid who's been to an international school in a location somewhere, say Indonesia or China or whatever, meets somebody and they say, oh, are you American or did you study in America? And he says, no, I studied in Indonesia. And it turned out, of course, they went to an international school where the teachers essentially imparted American accent. So there's again this question of accent. But the main thing is the cultural baggage that comes with an accent, whether it's geography, whether it's privilege, all of that, I think, comes in as well. Talking about the UN, that one of the biases that I don't think people entirely overcame, though I hope that's changing now, is gender bias, oddly enough, because I came to the UN having lived in India, where I was used to seeing women in positions of authority. We had a woman prime minister when I left India. My parents had friends, women friends who were CEOs, who were chiefs of various kinds of entities, magazines, magazine editors, CEOs of advertising agencies, heads of businesses, and so on. So in India, and of course, female doctors are very widespread and common. So I never saw in any particular sense that there was anything unusual about seeing a woman in a position of authority. And I guess growing up in a house with strong women, our mother and your sister, also predisposed me, I think, to looking at gender with respect or gender differences without any implicit negative judgment. Then I studied in graduate school in the States, and in 3 years there, of course, particularly in the mid-70s, there was a lot of consciousness of women's empowerment or female liberation or whatever you want to call it. And so, again, I was sensitized to that. And then I came to Europe and began work at the UN in Geneva and found, first of all, there were very few women in senior positions in the organization. And secondly, to my surprise, they were not treated by the men with a great deal of respect. I mean, I still remember my horror in my first month in the job. I was in a meeting where a senior woman, I think the most senior woman in the organization, which she was not in a very senior position in absolute terms, but she was very senior in the organization, came, said something in a meeting and then had to leave for another meeting. And after she left, all the men were sort of raising their eyebrows and giggling and saying, well, we don't have to take that seriously and things like that. And I was truly shocked. So I realized that even in an organization where a nationality bias, ethnic bias, linguistic bias were unacceptable, gender bias still persisted. And that was, again, quite a revelation.
I mean, and that's a brilliant story, Shashi, purely because I'm just thinking, as you just correctly said a minute ago, about our upbringing, yours, my sister's, and mine. And I often say to people, you know, why have I gone down this path of unconscious bias? Why am I choosing to talk about this and have such passion about it? And it's because I realize with the benefit of hindsight that certainly I speak for myself, was very lucky because we were genuinely brought up in an inclusive, liberal, accepting, non-judgmental household. And in specifically in relation to gender, now you are the firstborn, and you are the elder, and you are a boy, you are the son. And in India, certainly in the 70s, and even today, in many, many parts of urban middle-class India, the son is king. Whereas in our home, we did not feel in any way lesser than you. We were not given two biscuits while you were given three, metaphorically. And we were all treated with the same level of respect. And for that, we have to thank our parenting. And for me to have my sense of my own identity about not being lesser than because of my gender. And I think that's very powerful because it is about our narrative and how we are brought up that then impacts on our unconscious biases. But can tell me some more. I mean, maybe not the United Nations, perhaps something else. You've come back to India after 29 years and you're working now in India. What kind of stories can you share there in terms of unconscious bias?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. I was accused of a bias that I didn't have in my own constituency. I have this habit of being completely oblivious to caste issues. And that's partially because, of course, I've lived essentially all my adult life outside India. I left India at the age of 19 to go to graduate school. Straight from graduate school, I joined the UN, worked there 29 years. And when I finally returned to India, I had spent much more than half my life living abroad. And obviously, caste was not a consideration in any of the places where I'd lived and worked, number one. Number two, my own family life had now predisposed me to being conscious of caste. Our parents didn't tell us what our castes were. In my case, I've even written about in one of my books how I was embarrassed to be asked my caste when I was 11 years old, and I had no clue, and I had to go back and demand an explanation from my parents because I didn't even know what caste was. And that's partially because our father was from the nationalist generation who shared his caste surname in response to Mahatma Gandhi calling for people to shed caste. And so he dropped his surname. I've seen his school books where he used his caste surname Nair. He was TCS Nair in all the school books. And then suddenly in college, he dropped it and just became Tharoor Chandrasekhar and finally Tharoor Chandran, which then got reversed to Chandran Tharoor. So again, having a name that didn't give away your caste, being brought up by parents, particularly a father who was quite, indifferent to caste, or at least considered caste to be irrelevant in his life and his judgment of people, made me and you too grow up completely oblivious to caste. And so I lived that way. It was reinforced. I think had I grown up and lived in India as an adult and worked in India, I may have become more conscious of it. But coming to India in my 50s, it was too late to suddenly develop any caste consciousness. And I would meet people, I would never inquire about their caste, and I would have no clue what their caste was. And didn't matter. I would judge them with whatever unconscious bias, you know, the dark guy or the lazy guy or the mathematical wizard or whatever it may be, but not particularly on the basis of caste. And then at one point, somebody accused me of surrounding myself only with Nayars in my office in Trivandrum, in my constituency. And of course, Keralites are fairly caste conscious. And I had apparently either recruited or accepted the services of volunteers who were, for the most part, from one caste, the Nayars. And I hadn't realized that. In fact, it turned out when I inquired that the charge was not true, that at least two of my team were actually from the Uruba caste, and we had one Muslim as well. And then I went out of my way thereafter to look for Christians and people from other communities to get into the office, including a Dalit, in order to ensure that that charge couldn't be made against me. So it became a conscious effort to undo the accusation of an unconscious bias that, in fact, I didn't have.
That's funny. I mean, it's funny, but not purely because you didn't have it. And you didn't have it because it was out, I suppose, not being aware enough that some people see caste more seriously than you do. And therefore, they were accusing you of something that you were not aware of and you didn't have. But other than caste, I mean, see, you and I both have unconscious biases. There's no question about that. We will look at something, we will, you know, I can certainly share a story with you. As you know, I recently had a car accident last year. And your nephew's two friends came independently of each other and came and gave me a bunch of flowers. Now, same age as your nephew, so he was 27 then. And so there was a 27-year-old woman who came and gave me a bunch of flowers. Her name is Paola. And a 27-year-old man who also gave me a bunch of flowers. His name is Ben. And I was very touched when they both gave me these flowers. And then I said to Nihal, your nephew, my son, I said, I'm so impressed that Ben would have the wherewithal to buy a bunch of flowers and come and give it to, you know, an older woman just to make her feel good. And he agreed with me that we were both equally impressed. And then we began to talk about what kind of unconscious bias is that I don't feel that a young man, age 27, would have the wherewithal to think and buy a bunch of flowers for somebody like me. What kind of unconscious biases do I have then towards men of a certain age is what the question I was asking myself.
Well, since you brought up three of them, I think your biases are learned the hard way about what to expect of men of a certain age.
Well, possibly true, because I have three sons. But then you have to, so therefore the point about it is it's our narrative, you see. And your narrative obviously influences and impacts your unconscious biases. What I want to know is you've traveled around the world and you would have had some stereotypical expectations of X, Y, or Z. Those were all unconscious biases. And then with the experience of being where you were, did you realize they were unconscious biases and have you reflected on them?
Well, I think in all fairness, one has to say that because I was both in a work environment and in a country where one very consciously sought to avoid bias of any sort, I think my story is certainly not typical of the average person in India. So, for example, I find that many people in India, when I came here, did have some instinctive biases that I had either not acquired or had consciously shed. There was a lot of homophobia, instinctive, and not even homophobia in the sense of wishing anybody harm, but simply thinking of them in a negative way because of their orientation. I found there was a fair amount of caste prejudice. Again, it didn't have to be hierarchical. It wasn't that people thought they were better than people of other castes, but rather that they stereotyped the people of a particular caste as being identified with certain characteristics. And that's a very common practice in India. You know, a Marwadi is assumed to be a businessman and sometimes, you know, stereotyped as a sort of slimy one. A Sikh is considered to be fairly earthy, but also fairly dumb and given to drinking a lot. You know, that kind of stuff. And that comes across not just in jokes about these communities, but in assumptions when people speak. And that was quite a revelation to me because I simply didn't think of categories of people that way. Similarly, I think this whole question of nationality bias, I mean, you know, having worked at the UN, learned very early on not to even think of people in terms of their nationality, but rather in terms of their professional skills or their professional orientation. So, you know, you liked or disliked a boss not because he was Danish or Romanian. You liked or disliked him because he was either competent at his job or an unpleasant taskmaster or unfair in his dealings with you. You know, so there were always human characteristics, not immutable stereotypes that influence one's judgments working at the UN. And that was therefore, I mean, I'm not trying to sound smug or superior, but I did feel that one really comes out of an international work environment like the United Nations, particularly conscious of the need to avoid unconscious bias. And certainly in my case, once I started reaching senior levels of management, it was all the more important to be attentive to that, not to hire somebody for the wrong reasons, not to respect somebody's judgment for particular reasons. I mean, it was often said, for example, that a couple of senior English colleagues had a bias in favor of UN officials who could write good English. And therefore, however competent you were, you know, if you were a person for whom English was very much a second language, you stood no chance of being hired or promoted by them. So you have to really go out of your way to be conscious of the dangers of that and avoid that. And working with a man like Kofi Annan for the last a dozen years, or even little more than that, of my UN career, but for 14 years of my UN career, the person I worked closest with was Kofi Annan. I have to say that it was an extraordinarily educative experience, because this was a man who was certainly incapable of bias within his personal life or his professional life, and imparted those values to those who worked closely with him.
And that's actually very, very important to understand, because that also is part of your narrative, because 29 years in one organization that has certain values that you then, you know, you fit into, will obviously influence the way you see the world. And the fact that you don't think about nationalities and you just think about people is actually very powerful, whereas in normal corporate organizations, that would not be the case at all. That's great, Shashi. But let's just talk about something personal then, between you and me. Unconscious biases, growing up in our home with two younger sisters. Maybe they were conscious biases. I don't know. What was that like? What does it feel like growing up with two younger sisters?
It was wonderful in many ways, but I think it had more to do with age bias than gender bias. I think there was very much in Kerala culture a need for the younger to defer to the older and for the older to assume a certain authority over the younger. And I certainly grew up feeling that being the older brother entitled me to order you girls around and at the same time to have a certain protectiveness towards you both, which you two probably didn't need and didn't certainly require or demand, but which was implicit. Equally, you weren't allowed to call me by my first name. You had to call me elder brother in Malayalam. I sat at the head of the table when the three of us had dinner, and you girls sat on either side. I was the captain of the ship in the bathtub. So yeah, in many ways, there was an ageist bias very much built into our culture. It's probably actually pan-Indian, but certainly in Kerala, I noticed it very consciously whenever one went to the village. Because even a dunderhead was able to pull rank over the smartest kid in the family merely because he happened to be a year or two older. And that
but again, he or a she, though? Are you sure it was always... It could be either? But
yeah, I think
person?
So.
Right.
I think
well,
so,
now,
because the same rules
know.
Applied. Same rules applied to older female siblings. But between, say, an older female and an older male, the areas of authority may be different. And so again, in a more traditional village environment, which you and I would go to annually for holidays as kids, I think, you know, on matters of the household, of the kitchen, of who got to go to the shower or the bathroom first? You know, who was entitled to hot water? Who was going to eat first? Since there were so many of us, we couldn't all fit around the table. It would usually be an elder woman who would make that call and give the orders. But on other matters, organizing family excursions or games in the courtyard or whatever, it would often be an elder male who made that decision. But it was always an elder. Gender roles may have had certain biases attached to them, but age still carried a clout, which perhaps would be much less taken for granted in Western societies.
That's a good point. But something else that you said reminded me of our wonderful childhood, and that is the fact that we have the wonderful privilege of having an ancestral home. We still do in rural Kerala, in Palakkad. And when we were growing up, we were urban city kids in Bombay and Calcutta, and we would go to the rural village. Now, this experience of going from being an urban city kid to the rural village, in those days we had cows, and you know, we would get the milk from the cow, and we would go to the local pond to have a bath, and we're talking about extreme rural life. Do you think that, looking back with the benefit of hindsight, that you may have had some unconscious, positive or negative, they don't have to be one or the other, but unconscious biases between these two types of living, rural versus urban?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that, you know, we were a bit urban snobs. And particularly in those earlier days when we used to go to the village and there was no electricity, you had to take hurricane lanterns, there was no indoor toilet or plumbing, water was drawn from the well, and to go to the toilet, you had to go with a hurricane lamp into the backyard and make your way through the darkness to an outhouse. All of those things, and of course the mosquitoes, ever present and quite all-consuming. Certainly, I never looked forward in those early years to going to the village, because I did think that our life in a flat in a city was far, far more convenient, comfortable, and altogether better. So yes, there was a very conscious urban bias about village life. It's as we grew older and became more mature, I think, that all of us acquired a fondness for the simpler pleasures of the rural visit. And particularly before it became dark and the mosquitoes came out, you had gorgeously visual vistas around you, the hills, the green of the paddy fields, the breezes of the swaying coconut and palm trees. All of those things were something we looked forward to because they were so different from the city. And of course, once electricity came and you were able to challenge the privations, and indoor toilets were built and all of that stuff, I think that those inconveniences disappeared and the village became a much more attractive place to go to than it was in our early childhood.
Mm-hmm. I'm just visualizing, because I think you're being older than I am. I don't remember any time where there was no electricity, for example. And I remember my summer holidays with great fondness and nostalgia. There's no doubt about that.
Well, but there's my age bias. You were too young to remember all the stuff that
exactly.
I had negative feelings about.
I didn't experience that at all. It was all fun and completely different from my urban city life that I was leaving for the summer holidays. But okay, so we've talked about different types of unconscious biases. Now I'm sure you've reflected in different ways. So when you look back and all these different experiences you've had, how do you manage your own unconscious biases?
I think one has to be conscious about avoiding them. And so again, that may have been something I internalized in my UN years, of just being very conscious not to be biased about something and to be alert to ask oneself, am I taking the stand simply because I don't like someone for reasons extraneous to the merit of what they're saying? Or whatever it may be, you know, let's say there's somebody who, who's from, the obvious things are a different region, a different caste, a different linguistic group, a different appearance, a different sexual orientation, a different gender, whatever, whether that's influencing the way I am judging or regarding a proposal they make, an idea they advance, something they write, whatever. I'm very, very conscious not to do that. And therefore, I think the answer is that as far as conquering unconscious bias is concerned, the only way to do that is consciously. Perhaps you can't ultimately overcome your instinctive prejudices. Let's say, for example, I'm thinking of a friend who said something to me about having been repelled by homosexuals because in boarding school, somebody made a homosexual advance to him and he was completely put off. Now, I think the only answer to such a person would be to say, okay, you had an unpleasant experience, but don't let that prompt you into judging an entire category of human beings. The vast majority of him might not have tried to thrust their attentions upon you if you didn't welcome them. And generalizing from a particular is always bad. So maybe, you know, shall we say one blonde girl turned out to be particularly dumb. That doesn't mean that every blonde is dumb. There are lots of very smart blonde PhDs.
No, that's
so
brilliant,
never
brilliant
generalize
example.
From your experience.
Yeah.
So never generalize from an example.
Absolutely right. No, and that's exactly it, because so many of us would do exactly what you've just suggested as shared with us. This, you know, one negative experience and the entire group of people. It could be a nationality. It could be profession. It could be anything at all. And you say all people who work, you know, HR people, I don't like them. It doesn't even have to be a sexuality. It could be religion, nationality, a profession in United Nations. Oh, one person perhaps was not very nice. And then they say, oh, the UN, oh, we don't like anybody who works in the UN, because you didn't get along with one person, not you, obviously, but somebody else. And that's actually very valuable. So it's trying to really be conscious and think and reflect. That's brilliant. Okay, that's fantastic, brother of mine, Shashi Tharoor. Thank you so much for sharing your stories with me on Unconscious Bias.
Thank you, Smitha. It was a fun conversation, and good luck with all you're doing to help people overcome their unconscious bias.
Thank you for listening to my podcast, Stories of Unconscious Bias. If you enjoyed hearing this episode, do tune in every Saturday for a new interview. And if you could share, leave a review and rating, that would be hugely appreciated. You can find me on Instagram and Twitter @SmithaTharoor, and feel free to suggest new guests. Until next week.